scientists will tell you that if they scan people's brains while listening to negative campaign ads, it will light up a spot that triggers disgust and revulsion. Do they have to spend a lot of money to figure that out? You can just talk to any one of America's 71 million political orphans. Ugly campaign ads and car wrecks. Why we can't turn away in this month's Lost in the Middle.
I for president. You like Ike, I like Ike. Everybody likes Ike for president.
Hey, welcome to Political Campaign Commercials, vintage 1952. A black and white cartoon of a parade pushing President Eisenhower's campaign. Happy music, upbeat message. An elephant leads at the parade with the name of the World War II hero hanging from his trunk and a picture of him draped over his body. And, oh my God, this jingle goes on for a full minute. And tell me this earworm will not be haunting you when you try to go to sleep tonight. The vibe and the cartoon seem like a vintage Disney production, part of the Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs era. And whoops, did I just get canceled? I said the word dwarf. But here are what seem to be the movie inspirations for this generation of political commercials. No longer the candidate is hardworking, happy Fred Flintstone, but now focused on the opponent as the candidate as Michael Myers.
Halloween, the night he came home.
And the soundtrack of the day, the shower scene in Psycho.
So the music, the scary music, the black and white, the sounds, the eerie sounds, you know, for 27 seconds. And then at the very end, you often get sort of fade to black. And then maybe there's a slight break. And then there's a positive sound, a major chord or some sort of sound. And then you get, I'm Lynn Vavreck and I approve this message.
Well, Lynn's not a candidate. She's actually a professor of political science at UCLA, a student of campaigns in general, and a political ad junkie.
People hate attack ads. We've done lots of surveys, and you don't even need to do a survey. You just talk to your friends, your coworkers. Everybody hates attack ads.
If you live in a battleground state like I do, in Wisconsin, we're about to get carpet bombed. 10 years ago, we might have seen 20,000 ads in a political cycle. This year, the best estimate are more than 100,000 ads. One Biden super PAC just made its first campaign buy for $250 million. That's a billion with a B. And that's just the beginning. And the best guess is that the ad buy this cycle will be over $10 billion. In swing state Pennsylvania, that voted for Trump in 16 and Biden in 20, they're already scrambling for the air raid shelters.
I just hate it.
Tim's a real estate executive who was once active in politics, but not anymore. And like a lot of the lost political middle, he's not looking forward to this 24 campaign.
One of the best things I ever did was get rid of cable, because I don't see a lot of it anymore. You know, the 2020 election was a big push into me cutting the cord at home, because I was just sick and tired of watching it all. And so after having been so deeply involved in it, to actually extract yourself from it, it's been quite liberating.
Political campaigns run negative ads for one simple reason, because they work. Everybody says they hate them, but everybody watches them. And you can't get away from them if you live in a swing state like Pennsylvania. Here's Lynn, our UCLA professor.
You know, if you live in Los Angeles, you spend a lot of time on the freeways. And the freeway closest to UCLA is the 405 freeway. And everybody who's ever been to LA has driven on it. And you know that when there's an accident on the other side of the freeway, all the traffic backs up on your side of the freeway. Why? Why is that? Because people are slowing down to look at what has happened on the other side of the freeway. Now, if we go and ask those people, do you slow down and stare at the tragedy of another person? Do you gawk at this horrible accident that has happened to someone? And because you can't look away, you have to see it. People would say, oh God, no, like that's terrible. I would never, you know, take pleasure, be interested in someone else's tragedy. But we know that's not true because it happens to all of us on the freeway when the accident's on the other side. People can't help but look. And attack advertising is a little bit like that.
Look, the truth is, it happens to all of us. When the accident happens on the other side of the freeway, we all gawk. Political advertising is a little bit like that.
It's true. Absolutely true.
Mary's another Pennsylvania swing voter.
You will listen to it even though you don't believe it. But you will listen to it. And the worst part is not only will you listen to it, you will remember it. And when you go to vote and you look, why is that name familiar to me? Kind of an attitude. And it's right. It's like rubbernecking at a bad accident. You can't help but look. Human nature, I don't know. But it's a very good analogy.
We're going to take you back to Pennsylvania a little bit later, but let's take a detour for a moment to talk about why negative ads work. Well, the simple answer is because that's how our brains are wired. This is a short clip from an animated video produced by Professor Allison Leatherwood at UC Davis.
So once you frame something negatively, it really sticks. It makes sense from an evolutionary or functional perspective that our minds are built to look for negative information in the environment and to hold on to it once we find it. Imagine your prehistoric ancestors. You don't want to forget that there might be a predator lurking around. In many situations, we want our minds to be grabbed by the negative information so that we can fix problems when they're there.
Now I understand it. That's my kind of science, the eighth grade level. But if you want a more nuanced scientific explanation, well, we found one. We headed south in California, down Interstate 5, to track down a psychiatry professor at UCLA, Marco Iacoboni. He uses scans to track what actually happens to people's brains when they look at pictures of candidates. And as you'll quickly hear, he's got a cool Italian accent. But you're going to have to listen very carefully.
So there are many aspects of negative emotion that are still valuable for your survival, for your well-being. But in general, I would say it's much simpler to have to go from 0 to 100 with negative emotion than from 0 to 100 with positive ones.
And those negative ads light up a very specific part of your brain. It's where the brain registers disgust, the very place that makes you want to vomit.
Your amygdala, which is this brain little region, is very important for emotions, especially negative, not necessarily negative, but especially negative emotions, will go on fire. Will go on fire for those kind of ads. The one thing we found was that indeed, one area of the brain that is often associated with a feeling of disgust, such that if I stimulate electrically, if I have an electrode in your brain, in that area, and I stimulate that brain region, you're going to puke, literally. You're going to literally puke. So that region was activated mostly for seeing the opposite candidate.
You heard right. He didn't sugarcoat it. Political ads hit the button in your brain that makes you want to puke. I know some of you are listening thinking, hey, Klug, wait a minute. There was a golden time in American politics. The founding fathers is a happy family tossing footballs. Touchdown, Madison! And Jefferson and Adams on the sideline clinking bottles and high-fiving like a halftime Miller Lite commercial. Not. As soon as George Washington was out of the door, the truth is the first haymaker was thrown.
I think actually negative campaigning is the norm in American democracy. And the real question is, how did we ever get positive campaigning? Because it seems like pretty quickly people go below the belt and that actually tends to motivate voters. So the real historical question is, why would anybody not do negative campaigning? And how do they successfully take the high road?
That's John Grinspan. He's the Smithsonian's lead scholar on American political campaigns.
I mean, people will start with the election of 1800, that up through George Washington, it's all pretty polite. And he's, you know, the nation's general and the kind of paragon of virtue and doesn't come in for too much. But as soon as Jefferson and Adams are fighting in 1800, it really devolves into attacks on personality. And because a lot of what campaigning or what you're choosing then is the most virtuous candidate, it's pretty easy to tear down the other person's virtue about their alliances, about their spouse, about their perhaps their affairs, their economics, their financial situation. So people dig in, and it really goes downhill from there.
Within several decades, campaigns viciously attacked family members. Andrew Jackson's wife was the subject of horrific abuse.
Some wives and first ladies are attacked for being too involved in politics. Some are attacked for not being enough involved. It's often an easy target to pick at. She was from a humble background. She wasn't an elite lady in Washington, D.C. or New York or Charleston. She had a previous marriage that it's debatable if that marriage had been ended legally or not. So she comes in for all kinds of like aspersions on her honor and her virtue and everything.
And if you think Abraham Lincoln got a pass, you got it wrong.
And I mean, the most important thing is the just massive disinformation about Abe Lincoln. Lincoln is said to be an abolitionist, said to want to invade the South and free slaves. And he's really a moderate. He's not in any way an abolitionist. He's a moderate anti-slavery kind of slow candidate. And that's why he won the nomination. And yet people are just making up widespread lies about him and spreading them to the degree we call it disinformation today, that people really believe it as a truth. And so after the election, after Abe Lincoln wins, it's pretty easy for those 11 states to get around to seceding.
This podcast is brought to you by the American Property Owners Alliance. We are a nonprofit, nonpartisan organization that protects property owners and their interests. Did you know that in 10 states and Washington, D.C., the government can take more than what it is owed in property taxes in the instance of a foreclosure? From 2014 to 2021, 8,600 homes and more than $780 million in savings were lost to this practice, known as home equity theft. We are working to end home equity theft everywhere it remains on the books. Visit PropertyOwnersAlliance.org to join the effort to protect property rights.
Well, now that I've shattered all your illusions about the idyllic history of American politics, let's turn to today's food fight in the cafeteria, playing out in Pennsylvania. We zeroed in on Erie County, tucked in the northwest corner of the state. Hard to find Steelers or Eagles fans here. It's so close to Ohio, it's Brown's country. Mary's a retired hospital social worker.
I honestly don't know that anybody has a clue what direction it could go. And that in itself, because Pennsylvania is significant in the upcoming election, Erie, although not the largest county or the most populated, is just kind of baffling. And actually, in much of Pennsylvania, they view Erie as belonging to Canada. And so they're just sort of baffled by us. And we actually, I think, are kind of baffled by the election coming up.
Since 2008, there have been 25 state elections in Pennsylvania. And this weather vane county has picked the winner 92% of the time. Demographically, it's a little bit whiter, a little less affluent, and a little less educated than the state as a whole. But if you're going to win in Pennsylvania, your message has to sell here. It's no wonder that NBC News says it's one of seven counties in the country that will provide the leading edge clues to the winner in the 2024 election. And here's Tim again.
We're extremely purple. We've gone for Donald Trump. We've not gone for Donald Trump. We bounce back and forth. And people often say, as Erie County goes, Pennsylvania will go.
And we came to Pennsylvania for one simple reason, because it was the birthplace of a new twist in negative advertising in 2022. Democrats spending millions boosting Republicans in the primary. Huh? Yeah, you heard that right. The idea was brilliant. It was likely unethical and very Machiavellian. And as you will hear even some Democrats say, potentially very dangerous. The concept was simple. Amp up the most extreme Republican candidate to win the primary, defeating the moderate candidate, who was the more serious threat in the general election. Again, this clip is not paid for by Republicans, but by Democratic gubernatorial candidate Josh Shapiro, who dropped $1 million in ads like these.
And he led the fight to audit the 2020 election. If Mastriano wins, it's a win for what Donald Trump stands for.
Tim, one more time.
And it worked. And he ran against Doug and he did very, very well. Of course, he's the governor now. So it was a great strategy. But to see a Democrat actually pour money into a Republican primary to pick their candidate and to push these issues to the fringe, to push these fringe candidates, was a new strategy for us to see in Pennsylvania, and it worked.
And it wasn't just in Pennsylvania. Democrats pumped millions into six other states.
Donald Trump's hand-picked candidate for Maryland governor. Cox worked with Trump, trying to prove the last election was a fraud.
In Maryland, the Democrats spent $627,000, again in the primary election, to defeat the hand-picked moderate candidate of popular Republican Governor Larry Hogan, and sending election denier Dan Cox into the general election where he was, obliterated. In Michigan, the same strategy was used to beat a sitting moderate Republican congressman and a harsh Trump critic. This is from a PBS report.
Handpicked by Trump to run for Congress, Gibbs called Trump the greatest president.
In a Michigan swing district, Democrats poured $435,000 into promoting John Gibbs, who has spread election lies and conspiracies. He beat freshman Congressman Peter Meyer, who voted to impeach Trump. To Mike Madrid, a Republican who has worked to defeat Trump and election deniers, the strategy is hypocritical and a danger to democracy.
It's aiding and abetting a social movement that is trying to destroy our democratic underpinnings. And to be involved in that, to be engaged in that, is a moral travesty. It is literally feeding into the same toxicity that the problem you're trying to address has created.
This race in particular bothered a number of Democrats. Boosting an election denier was very risky, and Meyer was a Republican moderate who even voted to impeach Donald Trump. Two dozen former Democratic senators and representatives, including former Speaker Dick Gephardt, sent a blistering letter to the Democratic Campaign Committee. Despite the fact he's a Notre Dame fan, former Indiana Congressman Tim Romer and I have been friends since we first were elected in 1990. A moderate Democrat from South Bend, we worked together on a pile of issues, including higher education. He led the letter.
Why is this so wrong? Well, to me, it is wrong on almost every front. And I am a guy who is willing to battle, you know, tooth and nail in competitive elections. I know Democrats and Republicans both do it. They both are willing to battle. But Gibbs was an election denier. He told lies and conspiracy theories about the 2020 election, saying that Trump won and Biden lost. And when Democrats want to use that issue nationally to say, you strike at the heart of the transfer of power peacefully, of our Constitution, of our police officers and our fair elections, when you tell lies about 2020, we should not promote a candidate who tells lies about 2020, especially in a swing state like Michigan, where giving him more air to go from a primary to a general election and keep telling those fibs and lies and conspiracies could even come back to bite us in 2024.
But Bob Schrum, a legendary Democratic political operative whose campaign credentials include Ted Kennedy and George McGovern, pushed back on the criticism. We caught up with him at USC, where he teaches these days.
I mean, I think in the case of Pennsylvania, they worked because the core of the Pennsylvania Republican Party is a Trumpist MAGA core. And I haven't seen anybody suggest that what was in those ads was untrue. I've seen people suggest that it was unfair to convey that information to people. So, as I said, as long as we don't change the rules, as long as we're playing by the rules that we have, we're probably not going to see less of this. We're going to see more of it, even if people complain.
Well, I can see you now grimacing behind the wheel of the car as you listen to this episode. And I know what you're thinking. Why don't people run positive ads? Well, the fact is, they really don't work very well. Political science professor Ken Goldstein spent a chunk of his career at the University of Wisconsin, where I first got to know him.
There's definitely a performative answer where people will say, oh, that's dirty politics and that's negative and that's toxic and I don't like it. And then when you unpack it a little bit, positive ads are sometimes empty calories, right? There's not actually anything in there. When I was doing academic research on this, it was the case that negative ads were actually factually more accurate than positive ads. And it was also the case that sometimes how can you even fact check a positive ad, right? Scott Klug walking by Lake Mendota in a nice sweater in a yellow lab. I mean, that's great, but what am I going to fact check about that?
Now, as a quick aside, let me point out that if a positive ad doesn't work, how come he still remembers that ad from my campaign, which was 30 years ago? And if he was still alive, Watson would be offended. He would point out he was a golden retriever, not a golden lab.
I'm for ads that give people information. I'm for politics that gives people information. And we can all give an example of, oh my God, that was an awful, unethical ad. But there are relatively few of them, and they typically don't work because the other side can have its say as well.
For decades, the standard political campaign ad was a contrast piece. Those are the kinds of ads you can fact check, but like the Happy Eisenhower cartoon, part of a long bygone era. Democrat Bob Shrum again.
The biggest change is when you used to make a negative ad, you went to great lengths to make sure that you could defend its accuracy. Maybe it wasn't relevant in some cases. Maybe it was about a side issue in some cases. But you were really worried about what the news media would say about whether or not the ad was accurate. That's all gone. And the reason it's gone is because we don't have a kind of news media that function as filters anymore. Daniel Patrick Moynihan used to say, everybody's entitled to their own facts, to their own opinions. Nobody's entitled to their own facts. Well, today, everybody's entitled to their own facts.
I mean, up until at least kind of the mid-80s, negative ads weren't negative, right? They were sort of, here's the problem, here's your solution. They were all kind of contrast-based.
Nick Everhart is an Ohio-based Republican campaign consultant.
Probably the first race ad where that started to change, and as everything in politics, almost it has to happen at the, you know, some of the most aggressive sort of tactics and new things don't happen at the presidential, but some things it's like it has to happen at a presidential before it sort of seeps down. That 88 presidential race, right, between Dukakis and Bush, you know, the famous Willie Horton ad.
Bush and Dukakis on crime. Bush supports the death penalty for first-degree murderers. Dukakis not only opposes the death penalty, he allowed first-degree murderers to have weekend passes from prison. One was Willie Horton.
The attack was no surprise to the Dukakis campaign. For months, the stories about Willie Horton had dominated his home state, Massachusetts, papers. Here's Daniel Warner, the editor of the Lawrence Eagle newspaper, who broke the story.
My assistant called me up and said they caught Willie Horton. And I said, well, what do you mean they caught him? He's been in prison for life. Why are murderers being let out into the streets? We learned fairly quickly that he was out on a weekend pass, a furlough they called it, and he invaded a couple's house in Maryland, brutalized the man and raped the woman.
The ad was devastatingly effective, but it's still intensely controversial to this day. On one level, it played on the caricature of a liberal governor, soft on crime. The commercial had a clever shot of a revolving door in a state prison. On the other hand, it was a not-too-subtle racist attack with repeated use of an ugly, stark prison mugshot. Dukakis' campaign manager, Susan Estridge.
The impact and the effect, I believe, had a great deal to do with Willie Horton's race.
Horton was an ugly guy, and he looked like everybody's stereotype of a black thug. I can't believe when they made those ads, they didn't know what they were doing, raising racial fears.
And here's newspaper editor Daniel Warner one more time.
In a way, I tie this to the state of America today. This was somehow when we started beating the heck out of each other for totally political purposes. This ad, I think, hit at the inner fears of people, and it's just escalated over the last, 28 years?
And how about the ad exec who created that ad? His name's Fred Brown, and he doesn't have an ounce of regret.
It's like a baseball player. A lot of times you're going to do an ad and you strike out. Nobody even cares about it. It's rare that you have one where you swing and you hit and you just watch it sail. I'll always be glad I did it.
You know the old adage, what's good for the goose is good for the gander? Well, several years ago, the tables were turned on our Ohio political consultant. His opponent ran ads attacking him personally. Nick suddenly found himself an issue in an election.
The consultant, the other version of me with the other guy, ran an attack ad that used me in it. And we had had some history together, and it's a long thing. And there's a BuzzFeed story about my life and Rex Elsess, if you want to read about it. It's fascinating sideline stuff. But I'm in this negative ad, like being used as a decredentialing third-party villain, right? Like, I'm being associated as a hit. And it kind of bothered me. And my wife looked at me and said, "You've been doing this to other people your whole life." He said, "Buck up and go back to work and get over it." And she was right, you know. And but I'd never had that side of the table. And it does get you thinking. Like, there's, when you attack somebody or you attack them for a guilt by association thing to another person that's done something, like, there's somebody that sees that and has to kind of deal with that dynamic of it. So I've been a victim too, so I'm not just a perpetrator here, is what I'm saying.
Former Congressman Tim Romer saw the toll each increasingly ugly election took on his wife Sally and their four kids. And those campaigns were 20 years ago.
I think today there's no threshold. People are going back to candidates' high school days. They're going to their family members. They're going to their kids. There are all kinds of things floating around on the internet now about people that are, I think, out of bounds. I really, try to draw a reasonable and objective line between contrasting ads of what people believe in the two parties and the two candidates, and a torch and burn policy where, somebody is trying to just absolutely bury somebody and their families and never have them come out of the ground again.
Here's one interesting fact you might not know about running negative ads. For sure, the ads can make people strongly dislike your opponent, but like a car driving through mud, even an effective ad splashes right back on you. The Polarization Research Lab at Dartmouth has tracked the attitudes of 150,000 American voters to study the cumulative impact of negative campaigns.
Incivility turns people off of the sponsor. And this is especially true among political independents. You know, they see the negativity and they just become disenchanted with politics.
That's Jeff Lelkus. He's the co-director of the Polarization Research Lab.
Even if it doesn't cause people to stay home, it causes people to be mad. But it has this like system level negative effect of just like making people hate politics.
And some final thoughts from Congressman Tim Romer.
Young people, a lot of people don't want to run for office. They don't want to put themselves through the kind of thresher that we see in politics today.
And our committed Pennsylvania voter, Mary, thinks the cumulative effect of all those ads is very bad for our democracy.
The ads were, I don't have another word other than vicious. Why would anyone want to be in politics now? Why? Your family are going to get attacked. At least that's my perspective from Erie County.
I don't want to leave you totally despondent, so let's pivot to what we thought was the most memorable ad from recent campaigns. And hey, it's a positive ad, sort of. That might surprise you. When I was in Congress, it was the peak of DARE. It's a program aimed at sixth grade students to warn them about the dangers of drugs, formerly known as Drug Abuse Resistance Education. It was a well-targeted message for 12-year-olds, and local cops were always involved, especially in small towns in my congressional district. Oftentimes, I'd get invited to the graduation ceremony to be the speaker. I bring this up because the nights usually ended badly, with a group of small-town, white Wisconsin kids rapping. Oh, it was bad. They would eventually become the old white people who couldn't dance at weddings. And, well, those two themes merged together in one of the most memorable ads in recent years. A rapping white grandmother running for state senate in Utah.
Utah District 12, listen up right here. There's a new name on the ballot for the Senate this year. My name is Linda Paulson, Republican and awesome. Love God and family and the Constitution.
God bless her. She's 80 years old, a mother of nine, and catch this, a grandmother of 35. She taped it and danced around in her own backyard. And I use that term dance loosely. She is, after all, 80 years old.
If you share my values, if you like what I stand for, then give me your vote on the 8th of November, District 12.
And would you be surprised if I told you she won? Well, she didn't. Unlike the Eisenhower ad, it didn't deliver a win. But hey, at least you won't be wrapping yourself to sleep tonight. Here's the team behind Lost in the Middle. Executive producer Jeff Mayers. Producer Todd Elbaugh. Creative team Claudia Luz and Tony Wood. Edited by Aaron Zummers. Music by Brett William. Production at Civic Media. And a quick thanks to our partners at the American Property Owners Alliance. If you like this episode of Lost in the Middle, please remember to subscribe to our podcast. And if you enjoyed it, please tell your friends and pals.